Hello, and welcome to the 404 Media Podcast, where we bring you unparalleled access to hidden worlds, both online and IRL. 404 Media is a journalist-founded company and needs your support. To subscribe, go to 404media.co. As well as bonus content every single week, subscribers also get access to additional episodes where we respond to their best comments. Gain access to that content at 404media.co. I'm your host, Joseph, and with me are 404 Media co-founders, Sam Cole.
Hello.
Emmanuel Mayberg.
Is Jason wearing that because of the bridge?
I'm wearing it because it's opening day on Thursday. I'm wearing my Orioles gear. Huge Orioles fan. I'm from Maryland.
Go O's.
Happy baseball to everyone who celebrates. And also, the bridge fell down.
Yes. Joseph's trying really hard to introduce you.
And that last voice you heard was Jason Kepler. Jason, we have a quick announcement to give. What is it that we just launched today?
We just launched a full text RSS feed, meaning if you use an RSS reader, you can get a custom feed. And by custom, I mean it's tied to you, and put it in your RSS reader, and then you will be able to see past our paywall and our free walls, which is sort of like the email registration thing that we have. We wrote a big story about why and how we did this, but essentially it was quite complicated. This is something that exists for podcasts. The premium feed that you just mentioned is essentially like a long string of characters that are unique to each user, so that if you are a paying subscriber, you can use it, but you can't sort of like give it out to everyone. And it's not discoverable by searching on Apple Podcasts or whatever. You sort of like need to know how to find it. And so we developed this. We talked about it in length on a subscribers edition of the podcast that came out on Friday. So if you're interested, check it out. But we think that it's pretty important for the future of our company, but also for the future of sort of like independent subscriber-funded journalism more broadly, because we want people to be able to read our stuff, especially if they're paying to support us. But walls, like paywalls, sort of make that harder more broadly. And there, you know, there's this technology, RSS, that is very good for consuming media. I think it's sort of fallen out of favor, but is hopefully making a comeback. And so we had two companies, one called FeedPress and one called Outpost, help us develop this. And they are going to make it available to other people who are on the Ghost platform, which is the infrastructure that we use for our website. So if this is interesting at all to you, check out our subscriber episode and check out our article about how and why we did this.
Yeah, in the show notes, I will put a link to that article. And if you are a paid subscriber, you can click through to that. It'll give you a link to your own page and it'll come up with your specific custom RSS feed link. If you're not a paid subscriber, it'll also provide you an opportunity to sign up and then you can do that. And yeah, I'm very excited that this provides our readers an opportunity to consume our articles in the way that they want and also help the broader Ghost ecosystem and journalists more broadly. Speaking of journalism, let's get to the first story from Jason, a pretty complex one with some pretty interesting ramifications. The headline is, "Let's talk about the Flock study that says it solves crime." Before we get to this study, for those who don't know or who want a refresher, Jason, what is Flock exactly?
Flock is a surveillance startup. I guess you'd still call it a startup, but it's pretty big now. That makes automated license plate readers, which are called ALPRs. These are essentially cameras that detect license plates on cars and therefore can track the movements of cars around cities, around the United States, in neighborhoods. They sell this technology to police, but they also sell it to some businesses and then also some neighborhood watch groups and some homeowners associations. There's a few other companies that do this, but Flock is, I would argue, like the ring of like Ring camera of automatic license plate readers. It's very, very widespread around the US. And they have been adding some additional features, some like AI type features. And one thing that Flock has done over the last few years is they have used, I'm just going to say scientific studies, but we'll talk about this during this segment, but they've used scientific studies and data to market and sell its product. They have like published a bunch of papers that they say claims that Flock makes cities safer or that it leads to the solving of crimes. And last month, they published this study that the press release title was Flock ALPRs are, quote, instrumental in solving 10% of reported crime in the U.S., which is a major, major, major claim.
Was that specifically, was it them saying Flock is instrumental in solving 10% of reported crime, or was it saying automatic license plate readers?
The title was New Study Finds That Flock Safety is Instrumental in Solving 10% of Reported Crime in U.S.
Huge claim, yeah, as you say.
Huge claim, and sort of the underpinning of this study was it was written by two Flock employees. So the names of I'm using quotes, but the scientists on this study were two Flock employees. And then it also said that it had oversight from two other people. One was a criminology researcher at Texas Christian University, and the other one was a researcher at University of Texas at Tyler, which is a state university in Texas.
Before you get into those people, because we'll get into sort of those sort of outside researchers, but also involved researchers, but like just on the idea that Flock is performing and publishing research and it's done by its own employees. I mean, what do you make of that? Is that unusual? Is there a conflict there? Like, what do you make of that, first of all?
Yeah, we've written a lot about like predictive policing, these sort of like algorithms that find quote unquote like hot spots for crime, which would help police know where to patrol. We've written a lot about ShotSpotter, which is a gunshot detecting company. We've written a lot about ALPRs, and all of these startups are trying to legitimize themselves in some way. And often the way that they do that is by trying to get scientists to do research about them that shows that their product works. And the way that a lot of these places do it is through case studies. And so they will like pick a town and then they will look at crime stats before their product was introduced and then crime stats after their product was introduced and then draw a correlation between the introduction of their product and a better outcome in that city or town. Now, I can't speak to any individual scientific report, but people will know that correlation does not equal causation. It's
huge,
like
huge claim,
like huge, like tenet of science, where it's just like you can correlate any two things, and then you can try to say that these two things caught, like something caused that change to happen. And so, a lot. I'm just speaking broadly, but a lot of these case studies are like a correlation between a drop in crime or advanced, you know, crime solving and blah, blah, blah. And it's like crime is very complicated. It's has to do with, you know, services that are available, housing, drug use, policing, all sorts of things. It's like, I'm not even going to try to attempt to explain like what all of the measures that go into whether crime goes up or down. It's like crime went up during the pandemic, and then it went down after the pandemic. And this is like one of the huge things that our society disagrees upon now is like whether our cities are safer or less safe than they were, you know, these crime-torn liberal hellscapes. But then you sort of like look at this crime stats and in a lot of places, the crime stats have gone down. It depends on what sort of crime you're looking at, so on and so forth. And so Flock has done a lot of these case studies over the years where they look at individual, like different types of crime in different cities that use Flock cameras. And Forbes has been doing very good reporting on this over the last few months. Mm-hmm. I would suggest you go sort of read some of their reporting. Thomas Fox Brewster and Cyrus Farivar have been doing that reporting. But for example, something that you could do is you could take a snapshot of a time when crime is very, very high. Like you could say like crime fell in the previous like 17 months and 3 days or something like this. Like it depends on like what snapshot you're looking at, what the crime is, so on and so forth. And so it's like very hard to do studies like this is like the broad takeaway.
But yet Flock is
but well, so they're cherry picking things, they're publishing these things, and then we know that these are influential. We know that studies are broadly influential because we have looked at enough sort of behind the scenes emails that we've obtained using Freedom of Information Act requests, where we see cops like link to this sort of research and say, wow, this stuff works. And so we know that this research and these case studies are sort of used to sell these products in small towns and in bigger cities and at police conventions. And so this particular study that we're going to talk about, I know this has been a long wind up. It's like this particular study was written up by a website for police. It's like as Flock research, Flock gadgets are validated by this research. And this research was not peer reviewed. This research was very complicated, just in terms of like what it actually showed. And there are a lot of reasons to think that maybe this research was just fundamentally flawed. Forbes spoke to 7 academics, and all 7 of the academics that they spoke to said, this is like a bullshit study. Like it's not scientifically rigorous. It's sort of not how you would want research like this to be done. And I filed a Freedom of Information request with the University of Texas at Tyler, which is a public university, and got some of the emails from behind the scenes. And, you know, the researchers were sort of unaware of which cities they were even researching. It's like Flock anonymized all the data before it was sent to the researchers. The researchers therefore had no way of kind of like validating what they were even looking at. And then there's this one email that really stuck out to me where Johnny Nahan, which is one of the researchers at Texas Christian University, sent an email to a specific police officer and said, hey, we're doing this study. Can you please send us data for the last 2 years? And that researcher said, or sorry, that the police officer said, well, how about I send you the previous 3 years, because we're very low crime place. And if I send you the last 2 years, that will not, like, you're not going to find anything interesting during that time period. Mm. And so this researcher responds and says, quote, the 3 prior years will work. We definitely want to show a big swing, but let's discuss this and what we can analyze. And
so they're looking for a specific change there before actually getting the data. Allegedly, that's what the email shows. Yeah. And you asked this researcher about that email, right?
Yeah. And so, I mean, I look at this and I'm like, okay, everything I know about science is you're supposed to go in with a hypothesis, but you're not supposed to go in sort of like asking for data that will show a specific outcome, more or less. And so I took this to the researcher and I was like, look, man, this is a weird email. Like,
that's why what you said, right? Look, man,
pretty
it's
much. I don't have the email up in front of me, but I was like, yeah, what did you mean by this? Because this seems like not a good way of doing this sort of thing. And he kind of threw Flock under the bus, to be honest, which is, you know, I whatever.
Up to them, right.
Up to him. But he said, essentially, we were brought onto this study very late in the proceedings, and we started trying to do a quantitative analysis, and we thought that the data that we were getting was not good enough to do a quantitative analysis. He said that the data was too incomplete, that every sort of like police department collects this data in a different way, and it's all being sort of like sucked up by, you know, these researchers or shared with these researchers, and there was no way to do a good statistical analysis. And that's all he said. And I was like, okay, well, your name is on a paper.
Right, still did it.
I was like, your name is on a paper that does a statistical analysis. So like, what? And he was basically like, we were brought onto this very late.
Right, right.
And this isn't how I would have done it. And then he said, go ask Flock.
And you did do that, and Flock declined to comment, right?
Flock was like, no comment, essentially.
So even when you speak to the researcher who's providing oversight for this, and they have some issues with this study, they say go to Flock, which you were obviously going to do anyway. You go to Flock, and it's like, hey, this researcher has specific concerns. Here's an opportunity for you to clarify or defend, if you see fit, your own study. And they decided not to do that. Obviously, hey, it's their pejorative. They can not comment all day if they want. That just seems like an unusual response to me when given the chance to do so. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is that they're objecting to the release of more emails. Like, this university sort of said, like, we have other documents that we would like to release, but a third party has objected to their release, and that third party is named in the documents that I got as Flock. And so it's the reason that this headline is, let's talk about the Flock study that says it solves crime, is because it is very difficult to say this study is bullshit. Like, that is hard to say.
Right.
You can say, like, this is probably not how a study like this should be done. You can say this study is not peer reviewed, which is how you want science to be done. You can say the data is like very messy, in that, you know, it comes from a variety of different police departments in different size cities. It's looking at different types of crime. It's just like hard to do. But unless you like actively have all of the data and sort of know exactly how the study was done, you can't say this study is complete bullshit. Like, I mean, you can, but that would potentially be defamatory.
You can say anything.
And so I'm not. And so I'm not saying that. And it's just like tricky because, I don't know. It's like, it reminds me a lot of Big Tobacco, to be honest, as well as Big Oil, where Big Tobacco like commissioned its own studies on the health effects of cigarettes, and Big Oil has commissioned like a gazillion different studies on climate change. And it's like, depending on how you slice the data, what data you look at, where the data comes from, blah, 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 you can kind of show anything that you want to show. Whether that is the actual truth on the ground is a whole other question. And yet these studies are being used to push this technology all over the country. Ultimately, it kind of doesn't matter whether this research is peer reviewed, because the intended audience is not us as journalists. It's not even the public at large. It is police who are making the and city councils who are making the decisions about whether to buy this technology.
Yeah.
I'm glad you brought up the Big Oil and Big Tobacco studies, because the example that I always think of is, I think it was in 2019, there were a bunch of viral stories about this study on how hand dryers at public bathrooms, you know, the kind where you put your hands under them and they blow air on you and dry your hands that way, how they're really bad for hygiene and they blow germs all over the room and stuff. And a bunch of people covered it because it's kind of like a gross, fun thing to cover. But then people found out that the study was funded by like a paper towel consortium.
That's so
and
good.
It was like a
I didn't know that.
it was like a big paper towel, you know, hit job. And I agree that it's like the intended audience is not the general public or journalists or anyone like that. But then, and there are bad consequences for this because it's bad studies being used to sell potentially dangerous technology. But another side effect of it that I think is even worse maybe is that in aggregate, all these studies that have very specific interests kind of undermine the scientific process and like people's belief in science because they think that it's all subverted by greedy interests, which in some cases is true. But these studies are published, sometimes not peer reviewed, sometimes it's white paper, sometimes they're not even called studies. They're like they hedge a bit more and they're not published in any real journal. They're published on the company's websites. But some of these, you know, like the hand drawing study do make it into journals, and it just makes science look really bad. Which it's not. It's good. We love science. I fucking love science, as we say on Facebook.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point because, you know, this is called a study. It is like a study. I'm using quotes there because they did study something, but it's not peer reviewed. It's not published in any journal. It's published on this site called researchgate.net, which does have studies on it. And if you download it, it looks like a study. Like I've read many studies. It has an abstract. It has an introduction. It has the methods. It has blah, blah, blah. Like it has the conclusion. It has the appearance of a peer-reviewed scientific study, but it's not a peer-reviewed scientific study. It is a white paper published by a company that looks like a scientific study that was paid for by the company using the company's own data. And it's very like, unless you read a lot of studies and know about the peer review process and what journals are good and what journals are bad and how things get published, it's like you would have no idea, more or less. And this is like, it is relatively common for companies to fund studies that are done by academic researchers and for those to show up in peer-reviewed journals. But how this process works is very unclear to me as someone who has worked on it for a long time. It's like, and that's why I FOIA'd it. And that's why I hope I get more documents, because I have no idea how much these researchers were paid. You know, a lot of the documents I got were like 20 Zoom calls between these researchers and Flock. And so, you know, they're nominally like independent, like Flock says that they're independent, but they're being paid by Flock to do this. They had all of these like calls with Flock that we don't know what happened in those calls, because those calls are not really subject to public records unless they were recorded,
right?
At which they probably were not. And it's just like, what was said in those calls? Like, what was the purpose of this research? Like, was it actually independent? Like, we have no idea. I would suspect that it probably was not, given that it wasn't published in any journal and the scientists themselves were like, eh. Or at least, you know, one of the scientists said, I wouldn't have done it like this and I have a problem with it. And like his name is still on that paper. And I don't know. I don't know how he feels about it actually, but he took money to do this. So I don't really know how it works.
You also wouldn't know that if you read their press release, in which he's quoted in a very approving way.
His name is all over the press release as though he had done the study. And it's like, you know, what is the difference between overseeing a study and doing the study and being like the academic oversight for a study? Like, I wonder if, this is just me speculating, but I wonder if they wanted him to be a named author on the paper and he was like, no. And they were like, well, we're saying that you did oversight or something. Like, I have no clue, because these are the things that the general public is not really privy to.
Well, hopefully we get some more emails from your public records requests about this, and we'll see if we can get any more details on that. for the moment, we'll leave that Flock story there. I'm sure we'll come back to others. But when we come back after the break, we're going to talk about an article that Emmanuel and Sam teased in the previous episode, but we're going to go more depth into it this time. We'll be right back after this.
So my 404 media colleagues probably remember when I got doxxed, which was a nightmare for everyone involved. Mostly me, my name, address, phone number, social security number, and a bunch of other information was leaked online, which led to all these spam calls, harassment, threats, etc. Even if you're not a journalist, a sophisticated network of data brokers is making your personal information available to the highest bidder. I fixed my problem with Delete Me, which is a service that basically looks you up on all these people search websites and data broker websites and formally gets you removed from them. The subscription service removes your personal info from the largest search databases on the web, helping prevent potential ID theft, doxing, and phishing scams. I'm a real Delete Me customer. I've been using it for more than 5 years. Sign up is so easy. You just go to their website and then they send you personalized privacy reports showing you what info they found, where they found it, and how they got it removed. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now with a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/404media and use promo code 404media at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/404media and enter code 404media at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/404media, code 404media.
I'm Samantha Cole, host of the new season of Understood, the Pornhub Empire. Over the course of 4 episodes, I'll tell you how a horny YouTube knockoff in Canada came to dominate the porn world, only to shatter their cheeky reputation in a massive scandal. The Pornhub Empire is a new season of Understood from the CBC. Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, and we are back. This is an article written by Sam and Emmanuel. As I mentioned, age verification laws drag us back to the dark ages of the internet. We briefly teased this article on the previous episode of the podcast, but now it's out. We can go into some more detail. Let me just read a line from the first paragraph. And this is about these, you know, age verification laws that Sam has been covering a ton, most recently in Texas and Pornhub pulling out, etc., etc. We'll get into the context, but you basically know what I'm talking about. But the line reads, quote, "What will happen and is already happening is that people, including minors, will go to unmoderated, actively harmful alternatives that don't require handing over a government-issued ID to see people have sex. Meanwhile, performers and companies that are trying to do the right thing will suffer." Sam, we'll get into like concrete examples, but what do you mean by that? That, you know, people are going to leave more regulated sites like Pornhub and then go to these other ones? Like what do you mean by that exactly?
Yeah, so I mean, it's so just to give people, I guess, the context, if you haven't been following the age verification situation, which I guess a lot of people weren't until the Texas story. But so far, there are 7 states where people in those states can't just go to Pornhub from their normal IP address. Instead, you get like a page that says we're blocking this state because of age verification laws that were passed in your state. And those laws say that sites are required to verify the ages of visitors. Some of the, I think the laws are like use a third party system or something like that, but it's like verify the ages, of anyone who visits your site and make sure that they're not children. And to do that, it's like the only real ways to do that are biometric identification or driver's license, passport type of ID, government issued ID that shows your birth date. So, you know, Pornhub has basically said, Pornhub and all of its sites, which is, you know, I think few people maybe know that they're more than a dozen sites under Pornhub's kind of sister sites under Alo, their parent company. You can't go to any of those sites in multiple states at this point, which is a big deal. This piece was in the portion that you just read out, the thesis of the piece, and I'll let Emmanuel also get into it too, because this was, I think, his brainchild to begin with to write this piece, and just to say our, speak what we've been seeing in one story. But the thesis of it is basically because sites like Pornhub and all of its other sites in the network are trying to comply with the law and are compliant with the law by just not servicing in those states, people are just going to go to the easiest path. They're going to take the least resistance possible, and they're going to go to the next porn site when they are looking for porn, which, if we're talking about minors, you know, a lot of the time they aren't accessing porn just by Googling boobs or porn or whatever, sex. I don't know what kids Google. If you were going to do that, the next several things that come up in your search results are going to be sites that are based outside of, you know, the US or outside of, you know, any state or any country that's going to actually abide by any of these laws, or, you know, just doesn't give a shit about these laws and are full of actual abuse imagery and things like non-consensual porn, deepfakes, child sexual abuse imagery in some cases. It's just pushing people to those less moderated sites.
A ton of piracy, we should say, is probably the most rampant thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So people stealing from porn performers, which is why we make the point in the story. We talked to porn performers in the story about how having people go to sites where people just steal, you know, OnlyFans content or steal, you know, rip off whole films, whole scenes, and put them on other sites that aren't moderated, is really going to hurt them a lot. So, yeah.
So basically, yes, there's this law that says you're a porn site, you must collect people's ages and verify. Pornhub is like, we don't want to do that. We don't want to collect people's IDs. So what we're going to do is just not service those states. They pull out. And then people looking for pornography are going to get directed to these other sketchier sites, basically. Emmanuel, how did you come up with the idea for this piece? Because Sam said it was sort of your brainchild. How did you come up with it? And then let's get into some more examples of, what people are being directed to. How did you come up with it?
I think just when Sam covered that you can't access Pornhub in Texas, that really struck me and a lot of our readers as well. A lot of people read that story. I think it's a huge population, as we've said. And also at that point, we were able to look back and say, wow, this isn't quite a few states. And it's just crazy to think that such a huge site is not accessible in those states. And the fact that Pornhub is kind of like the default choice for people to watch porn made me think, well, okay, what is the next option? And I know a little bit about this because Sam and I look at these websites all the time. And because we've covered Pornhub for so many years, Pornhub has changed a lot and has become a safer, better website. But these other options, these other Pornhub alternatives, which we have also contacted many times over the years, are not as responsive. A lot of them operate out of Eastern Europe. They just don't really care to respond to the press. They don't really care about the law that much. There's not a lot that U.S. lawmakers can do to them. So those websites are pretty bad. And I just, you know, the thought experiment was like, okay, you can't access Pornhub in Texas. What are you accessing? And the answer is, that stuff is pretty bad.
How do you know that people are accessing these sites? Is it more that you've done a Google search for common terms and then you see what comes up? Like, how do you do that thought experiment, if you see what I mean?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. One is, yeah, it just like search for porn And the first result is Pornhub. And the second result is Xvideos, which is also involved in some of this legal action in Texas, but is a much worse website than Pornhub. And I think is based out of Czech Republic, Sam, is that right? And that is kind of like the number two site that people will find, just common sense. That's what's going to happen. And I think we can also say we've seen some like web traffic data that shows that access to those other sites has gone up since the law went into effect in those states. So there's also that.
Can right. I read something from someone on Threads? Because I posted, you know, a link to this article, and Cradle Under the Star on Threads wrote, "This isn't even theory. I've lived in three countries where porn is completely banned, and in all of them, there's just a bunch of unmoderated porn being consumed and pushed around. I understand the decision, but it's probably not the best move, America." And I think that like, if I just think about it rationally, it's like these bans will go after the big American platforms that have to or are willing to comply with it, but then there's porn on Reddit. Like, this is part of the article. It's like, there's porn on Reddit, there's porn on Twitter, there's porn on like many different platforms, but there's also porn on Telegram, there's porn on WhatsApp, there's porn on like a bunch of different sort of underground, not even underground, but it's just like people will find it.
And I think, it's also, I mean, another part of the reason why we wanted to kind of lay it out for people and say, this is what's going to happen if you really follow this thought all the way through, is the idea of restricting access to porn for kids is like, everyone can get behind that, including pornographers, like including sex workers. No one wants children seeing things that they shouldn't. No one wants kids watching their content when they're sex workers and porn performers. So it's like, the idea is a good one, and it's like, it makes sense, and it's usually bipartisan. And, when we talk about it, and it's like, you can't really confront this problem without people, or you can't challenge this problem and challenge the way that it's being done and being handled without people being like, oh, well, you're a creep, you want kids to be able to see porn. It's like, no, it's just this, the way that it's being done is going to have the opposite effect than what is intended here. And it's like, you know, why is no one listening? And I think, when people just casually hear, oh, age verification, yeah, sure, of course they should have to verify their age. And it's like, no, actually, like, eventually you're going to have to verify your age to do anything on the internet. And is that really like a world that you want to be in?
I would also say yes, but it's like those, the Pornhub's position and any adult performer's position has to be understandably and justifiably that they don't want minors watching their content. But we also have to be adults and like recognize the reality that it is impossible. It is literally impossible to create a situation or any system of laws that creates a world in which a human being does not see pornography until they're 18 years old. It's just like, it's impossible. It's impossible. It's just like, and that is before the internet, right? It's just like, teens are going to watch porn. They're going to see pornography in some fashion. And the harder you try to restrict pornography, the more you push legitimate producers and distributors of pornography out of sight and make it so the only option are really bad players, which is already what is happening because of these laws.
Yeah, and one of the performers in the story says that. He's like, I was looking at porn way before I was 18, and there was no fucking internet. You know, he's in his 40s. So it's like, it's a moralizing problem that people are trying to twist the arm of the legal system in order to do parenting for them, is my opinion. But you know, it's shaking out in ways that are going to affect all of us eventually. It's not just like, ooh, look at that icky porn. It's, this is going to be your whole life on the internet if people don't speak up about the porn part.
Yeah. Emmanuel, you mentioned these bad players. There's just a short list here of like some examples. And in the piece, you specifically have not named particular sites because you don't want to direct people to them. That's a pretty common practice for us as journalists. You know, we want to report on issues, but we don't want to amplify the actual harms that come with them. And I think that's pretty standard for us at this point. But there's just three examples here. And, you know, maybe I'll alternate between you and Sam on these. But the first is just when people are not going to Pornhub, they're going to go to these other sites and maybe they'll see, you know, deepfakes and generative AI. Obviously, we've covered that a lot. But like, what are you seeing on these sketchier sites when it comes to that sort of thing?
I think the sketchiest site. First of all, let me back up and say we do name Xvideos because it is so big and sort right. of advertises itself and is part of this legal action in Texas. So we felt comfortable naming it. However, if you know anything about how Xvideos operates or you work there, please get in touch with us. We would love to talk to you. Another website that we don't name, but is fairly popular, is currently including a link to a Nudify app on every single one of its posts. And these Nudify apps, we talked about them before. Essentially, these are websites where you provide an image of a person and some software makes it look as if that person is naked. Very harmful. We're seeing them used in high schools across the country. Some teens have already been arrested. Jason and I wrote a story about charges against some of these teens in Washington State. Just incredibly disruptive, harmful content. And, you know, this is a website that is pushing it on its viewers and not just like it's not something you have to go and find. It's like literally advertised alongside the porn.
Yeah. And then the other one, which Sam, I'll let you answer, is that there was this series of videos which then turned out to be a full-on criminal sex trafficking ring called Girls Do Porn. These were videos in which women were coerced or forced into having sex on camera against their will. They were heavily misled. These videos were on Pornhub for a very, very long time. Pornhub eventually took them down. So Pornhub is now a safer website in that regard. Again, not perfect, but safer in that regard. But it sounds like that you're seeing other websites where these Girls Do Porn videos are still available. Like, is that right? And like, what are you seeing?
Yeah, I mean, this is an issue that like not even the very good lawyers for the Girls Do Porn victims can fully address. You know, it's like getting that content off of the internet in places where the administrators and the webmasters don't care. Like they cannot be forced to take some of this stuff down. So like, that's an example of what we're talking about where it's like, you can't really just like, there's no way to contact them in a lot of cases. We don't know where they are based. There's not a person to say, hey, this is my content. I want it off of the internet. And Girls Do Porn is one of those cases. It's like, they own that content legally and they can't get it taken off of places where it shouldn't be, which it shouldn't be anywhere if they don't want it there. Yeah, it's like it's on these other sites and it's just going to stay there presumably forever because they're based all over the world through anonymous servers, you know, and they just don't really care. That's the point, you know. So
do we know where some of the other sites are? I know Emmanuel said Eastern Europe, but I think a couple of specific countries come up in the piece. I don't know if they're like confirmed or not, but like, what's the deal there? Any specifics?
Do you remember? I don't remember off the top of my head, Emmanuel.
I mean, the countries are Czech Republic is one. Poland is another. Those are the two that come to mind.
Okay, sure. Yeah. That makes sense. Well, it's a really, really great piece. And I really encourage people to go read it because not only is it really nuanced to an issue that I think is exceptionally complicated and it might take a while for some people to like get their heads around it. It's not only that, but it's also heavily reported as well. And Sam and Emmanuel are the best reporters when it comes to figuring out what is actually happening with sex and abuse and AI online. So I definitely recommend everybody goes read that. If you are listening to the free version of the podcast, I'll now play us out. But if you're a subscriber, we're going to talk about how we dug into the new owners behind Deadspin, the sports site. Well, maybe not a sports site anymore. You can subscribe and gain access to that content at 404media.co. As a reminder, 404 Media is journalist founded and supported by subscribers. If you wish to subscribe to 404 Media and directly support our work, please go to 404media.co. You'll get unlimited access to our articles and ad-free version of this podcast. You'll also get to listen to the subscribers only section where we talk about a bonus story each week. Another way to support us is by leaving a 5-star rating and a review for the podcast. That stuff really helps us out. And please just tell your friends about the podcast as well. This has been 404 Media. We will see you again next week.